Welcome everyone to this session. My name is Tim, I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to Path Through the Programme, a 10-part survey of various aspects of the AA programme with a couple of different formats designed to appeal to both AAs and Al-Anons, or indeed anyone using the 12 steps. We're ordinary members of the fellowship and we don't speak for AA or Al-Anon. We hope you find our experience helpful. The format of this session is as follows. James and I will speak between us for about half an hour on a topic. As we are speaking, you're encouraged to write any questions you have on slips of paper. Paper and pens will be distributed. Our assistants, Alistair and John, will collect these during the meeting. We will then select questions and, if we can, address them by sharing our experience. The session will last 50 minutes in total. The session is being recorded. Recordings will be made available online over the next few days at a member's personal blog site, which is not affiliated with AA. The QR code, The QR code and site address are available here on the front table. Let's start with a few moments of silent prayer to use as you wish. Thank you. This session's topic is applying the program to relationships. And James is going to kick us off.
Hey everyone, I'm Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jimmy.
Thank you, Tim, for letting me come and speak on this interesting topic. I wanted to start with a quote from Chuck C, which I think is perhaps the best thing I've read or heard about relationships in recovery. So Chuck says, "There's no barter in love. You do things because you want to, with no strings on it at all. Marriage isn't a 50-50 thing. It isn't a 75-25 thing. Marriage is 1,000 to nothing. You don't barter. You don't barter with God, and you don't barter with each other. That's the simple, unadulterated truth. The motivation is love, and love is the fulfillment of the law." So that was not my attitude when I came to relationships, or when I came to AA, when it came to relationships and when I came to AA. I guess I could be described as the, you know, out of the two, characters that is described in the, at the, in the 12 and 12, at step 12, you know, the controlling alcoholic and the controlled. I have a controlling streak in me when it comes to relationships. And I have this sort of selfish attitude that the relationship is simply for my own pleasure and my own needs. And I try and control and manipulate and do what I whatever I can to kind of get my partner to play the role that I think she needs to play in the relationship and in order to get what I want and to impress the people that I think I need to impress. And none of that is helpful when it comes to forming loving partnerships with other human beings. I've been in a relationship for the majority of my recovery. I got into a relationship when I was 6 months with my current partner, and for the first 3 years of our relationship, we kind of played this alcoholic-y dance where we were together for 3 or 6 months, and those first 3 months were fun and intimate and exciting, and then eventually I would get resentful for one reason or another, and I wouldn't be able to see straight. You know, all I could see were her faults, and eventually, you know, I'd end the relationship, and one thing led to another, and after a matter of months or something, you know, we'd drift back together, and that happened like a few times over the first 3 years of us seeing together, and on the last time that happened, at that point, I was kind of taking my program a bit more seriously. I was reading the book. I was trying to practice this stuff in my everyday life. And I made a commitment to myself and to my partner and to God that, you know, this time I would stay. You know, I would work on my, I would clear my side of the street, and less something, you know, morally corrupt or inhumane happening, that, you know, I was just going to stay in the relationship and do whatever I could to stay. And so that was over, that was about 3.5 years ago. And we're still together. We have a baby. Last year we had a baby. We moved house twice. We went to live in Australia for 3 months. All amazing stuff, but as you can imagine, quite challenging for two alcoholics with a newborn baby. You know, I've found that I've had to throw everything I possibly can at staying in the relationship and keeping one step ahead of my ego. I'm gonna kind of just talk about a few suggestions or directions which I've got from the Big Book. And for me, the pages kind of 80 to 120 or so, the last pages of Interaction, working with others and then to wives, I found particularly helpful when working in relationships. So page 84 says, love and tolerance of others is our code. And that, I think, is probably, apart from even not even in relationship, but in AA and my recovery as a whole, is probably one of the most important pieces of advice I get from the Big Book, apart from don't drink. Love and tolerance of others is our code. If, whenever I'm in any situation with my partner, I'm always trying to be loving and tolerant. Always, never perfectly, but that's the aim. On page 89, it says, cooperate, never criticize. To be helpful is our only aim. I've really struggled with the criticism part of this, and slowly but surely, you know, I've come up with strategies that to avoiding criticism. The one that I probably use most of the time is just holding, you know, restraint of pen and tongue, going for a walk around the block, talking to another alcoholic, doing whatever I can to change my perception or change my mind about the situation. The next suggestion or direction I have is on page 98, which says, argument and fault finding should be avoided like the plague. Again, just like any other resentment, I have to use every ounce of willpower I have not to entertain fault finding. And then page 111 says, the first principle of success is that you should never be angry. Again, you know, I have to do whatever I can do in order to restore my sanity before I go into any sort of interaction with my partner. If often, you know, I'll find myself getting wound up about something. Something as trivial as how my partner is stacking the dishwasher or and something like that. And, you know, it's those sorts of things that really get me in trouble. And when I know I'm off the beam and I want to say something and I know I just have to go and do what I need to do in order to, like, regain my sanity. I, you know, even that, if that means just, you know, again, leaving the room, talking to an alcoholic, doing the inventory, perhaps even waiting until the morning to see if there's actually anything valid to say. And 99 times out of 100, there was no issue. You know, it was all delusion. It was all my ego. I heard someone say recently, I've never regretted something I didn't say. And that's a useful piece of advice. And lastly, again, on page 111, our next thought is that you should never tell him or her what she should do about his or her drinking. Regardless of drinking, I found that I should never tell my partner what to do, particularly around childcare. or a lot of topics. That's just not part of the deal anymore. And so I found that, you know, when I started to practice these sorts of principles in the relationship, you know, God would start to reveal himself to me, and, you know, we could have intimacy, and we could have love, and we could have, you know, a beautiful relationship. And there was a one sort of aha moment that I had when our baby was about 3 months old, and I was holding our baby Una, and I was, you know, looking at her and in her innocence and her beauty, and I remembered the thought coming to my mind that, you know, that this baby, you know, she doesn't need to be any better or any worse than what she is. And then it struck me, you know, that's kind of how my higher power thinks about me. You know, I need to be no better or no worse than what I am. You know, I can certainly improve in areas, but my higher power will love me unconditionally. And then I kind of thought, well, perhaps that's the sort of attitude that I need to bring into my relationship, and my relationship with Izzy, but then also my relationship with you know, all of God's kids. And so it's those sorts of things which, you know, have helped me along the way. And I've found also that, you know, when I treat my partner in the way that she should be treated, in the way, and you know, which is distilled into these ideas in the Big Book and other spiritual literature, then when I treat her the way that she's treated, I actually get what I want, what I've wanted all along. And what I've wanted all along is a connection with someone that I love. But if I don't do the things that I need to do in order to stay on that spiritual beam, then everything deteriorates. But I think that's about all I've got, I think.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
So my name's Tim, I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a member of Al-Anon. There's an American speaker now deceased called Clancy, who says the call that every sponsor dreads is the one where the sponsee says, "I've met someone." When I saw her emerging from the treatment centre, I knew we were meant for each other. And I had a number of what could be called relationships before I got into AA. I think there were more hostage situations than anything. Since I've been sober and coming to Al-Anon, I was in a relationship for 8 years with another alcoholic in AA. And then we drifted apart. We're sort of terribly good friends. And I've been in a relationship with a non-alcoholic now for 20 years. So I'm obviously not an expert on anything, but I do have some experience, good and bad. So hopefully some of that will come through. My notion of a relationship before I started to get well was was not how I conceived of it at the time. This is what I now understand was happening. It was as though I'd said to myself, there is something very, very wrong with me. There is an emptiness, a sadness, a sense of loss, a sense of abandonment, a sense of separation. And if I meet someone, I think I'd read a book about a book about a book about Plato and had got the idea that... And I'd watched too many films on Channel 4. So I had this idea that if you put together two broken people, you end up with one whole person. And so I would scrub up reasonably well, at least for the first few dates, and get into a deal with someone where I offer you my complete incapacity to love. I'm going to offer you my emptiness, but all painted with gold on the outside. So I'm, and you're going to offer me your specialness. Your, the specialness that you're offering me is going to fix me. Then I'll be good enough to be with you because you've now proved that I'm okay. Now, of course, whatever frequency one is vibrating on, one will attract people on the same frequency. So I met people that were playing the same game. So it's as though we offered each other our incapacity, all wrapped up in the gold paper. And then you sit there on opposite sides of the room, unwrapping the present that the other person that has given you, and you look inside and there is nothing there. And you're like, you fucker. I've given you this great gift of myself, which I know is a fraud, and I feel as though you've defrauded me, but actually I've defrauded you. There's a great AA speaker called Don P, sadly deceased, who said, I don't know how to have a healthy sick relationship. If the fundamental construct of the relationship is sick, I don't know how to fix that. And in I've sponsored a lot of people over the years. Most of them have never forgiven me. And a lot of the conversation has been about relationships. And these days, I kind of won't really go there. There'll be some basic things that Jimmy has talked about, those basic ideas, pages 98 to 99 of the Big Book, to be sober, considerate and helpful, regardless of what the other person says and does, avoiding criticism and fault-finding like the plague, all of the other things between chapters 8 and 9, the family afterwards and the chapter to wives. There's some wonderful stuff in there. I'll go through that. But there's a very curious thing that I've experienced as a sponsor, sponsoring people that have had relationships which were very similar in dynamic to the sort that I had when I was out there drinking. And I'll tell a story. This is going to seem like a weird digression, but Clancy, again, tells a story about a 12-step call where someone from the group, from his AA group, called up and said, Clancy, I was sober 3 months, but I've let you down, I've let the group down, I've let myself down, and I got drunk. And Clancy said, I'll come over and we'll talk it through. And he spends all night talking to him. And he gets back home, 5 o'clock in the morning, sleeps for an hour, gets in the shower to go to work, thinking, oh, I've had 1 hour's sleep, but I've been helping an alcoholic all night. And I've done a good job, so I feel great about myself. And he gets a call, and it's this chap. And the chap says, Clancy, I thought you said you were going to come over. Because he was just so out of it, he had not realized any or remembered that anyone was even visiting him. And people tried to help me when I was in that bubble of sick relationships. And whatever people said was written on wind and water. Nothing could penetrate. And I don't know how to get in there and fix someone who is trapped in one of those cycles. I've had the experience where you think you've helped someone and then you get the call, we got back together again. And you realize it's just clicked. It's like a slip. It's clicked back to the beginning of the cycle again. I only started to get well with relationships when I sorted out literally everything else first. So I learned how to work. I learned how to be a friend. I learned how to look after my home. I learned how to be a good home group member. I learned how to sponsor. I learned how to be sponsored. I learned how to be part of my community. I learned how to be part of society. When I got to the point that I didn't care if for the rest of my life I was single or with someone, then I was in a position where I was eligible for the early foothills of even being in a relationship. Until that point, whatever deficit I had was not going to be fixed by the relationship. The only problem that a relationship has solved is the problem of not being in a relationship. Whilst I want the relationship to solve anything else, I've booby-trapped it from the get-go. And I've heard some wise people in recovery in AA and Al-Anon who've helped me enormously with this. One person said once, I said many, many years ago, I'd like to be in a relationship. And the person said, if you find in your life that you lack opportunities for service and you lack opportunities for forgiveness, then have at it, because those will be the two virtues that you will have to practice in the relationship. Only if you have a surplus to provide to someone else, expecting nothing in return, then by all means have a relationship. And my other half and I, someone sent us an anniversary card once, which I think illustrated for me perfectly what the purpose and function of the relationship is. And it was a picture of a rowing boat which was floating down a stream. And in the prow of the rowing boat were sitting two Labradors, just sort of looking out very proudly, looking at where the boat was going. And the reason this was a perfect image, if you imagine the energy that a dog needs to expend to paddle down a river, that they can swim, but it's hard work. But they've got the boat and they can just float down the river. And the point of the relationship in my marriage is not to give me anything, but to give a home base of strength for both of us, so that we, when we're going out in the world doing the various things that we do, we have somewhere completely safe, completely neutral, completely hospitable to go back to, which gives us strength to do things we couldn't otherwise do. And the Chuck Chamberlain thing about it's, you know, 1,000 to nothing, giving of yourself for fun and for free, expecting nothing in return, which is the Dr. Paul O line on the subject matter. Necessarily, there are lots of things that I might have done differently with my life. I was actually planning to move abroad when I met my other half. I would be in the mountains of Bavaria now, I think, if I hadn't met him. One has to give up an awful lot in order to accommodate the other person. But as soon as I see it as giving something up, I'm sunk. I'm not giving anything up. I'm investing myself, because I believe the returns that will be given to the world, not back to me, by me investing myself, are worth it. So I'm with someone who is doing such valuable things in the world. I don't care if a particular personal ambition of mine isn't met, because as a whole, what we're doing together is much more important than any personal ambitions I might have. About 14, 15 years ago, I went through a slight wobble in my relationship, and I happened to be in Texas. And the wobble was not because there was anything wrong or because my other half was doing anything wrong. I want to be very clear about that. I had built some sort of ridiculous phantasm in my mind that there was a problem. There was no problem. But I had this little sort of knot of darkness, which pre-existed the relationship. It was from before, but I sort of believed that it was arising in the relationship. I was in Texas. My sponsor is Texan, as you can hear from my accent. and his sponsor, a chap called Jim, who got sober in 1957 and is still alive and still sober, he said, go and talk to Jim. And I got an hour with him and I told him the problem, and he said, whatever you do, do not bring this question up with your other half. You have no right to introduce your darkness into the relationship. This is your problem. Do not make it his problem. My old friend Edwina, who is an uncompromising realist, She's a director of public health. She's also a pathologist, and she's got this pathologist's table, which she would perform. She'd buy whole pigs and chop them up and put them in the freezer. And she could butcher an entire pig using her skills as a pathologist who would perform postmortems. This is someone who is very much grounded in reality and is not squeamish about things. And she said, if you want to kill a relationship, tell the other person exactly what you're feeling. It'll be dead in 6 months. We need to talk about us. Do we? Do we really? Or do I need to talk to my sponsor? Who do I really want to talk to? Who do I really need to talk to? And the model that I operate with, which I've learned in AA, I've learned in Al-Anon, is I have my own private domain and space and life. He has his own private domain and space and life. And then we have a common ground on which we meet. And that is where the relationship is. And I thought for years, because he's very secretive, he's like a very old iPhone. When you turn it on, it's like great for 12 minutes, but then the batteries run down. You need to plug it in for 2 days and then you'll get another 12. He's very introverted. And I thought for a long time that he was concealing all sorts of very important things from me. No, he was dealing with his own stuff rather than making his own pre-existing stuff my problem. I came into recovery thinking that what is real is dark and what is light is bullshit. And sometimes one hears it in a meeting. Someone tells a very great tale of woe with no happy ending, and then everyone shares back and says, thank you for your raw honesty, as if anyone that's having a good day is lying. And I understand that, because that's exactly the attitude that I have as a teenager, being drawn to writers, to artists, to music, which was dark because dark is real. And it's the other way round, I've learned. And so the light space that my other half was creating in the home, I learned after many years, was actually the reality which I'd been seeking the whole time. So we have this space, we keep other stuff outside. It's almost like, it's sort of temple-like in a sense. A couple of years ago, I was going through whatever. There were circumstances which were producing a physical strain just because of the amount that I was having to do with looking after a very sick relative, close relative, and all my other obligations continued as usual. And I came home 9:30 at night, about to cook the dinner, and out of my mouth came a 15-second complaint about the day and the circumstances and the this and the that. And this is an example of how someone can point you in the right direction, but do it kindly. He stopped me and he said, that, and he gestured in the general direction of what I said, that needs to stop. If you permit it, it will take over. Tell me something good that happened today. He did not want the home to be poisoned with what I was going to bring to it. And there's a story, I know, I apologize, people have heard this before, but it's the Sentinel story. About 3 years into the relationship, I was doing the washing up loudly, because if you do the washing up loudly, what you're doing is telling the other person it's their turn to do the washing up. And he hadn't read the script, although he had, and he knew not to react. And so I escalated to verbalizing the idea that maybe it wouldn't hurt if he did the washing up occasionally. And he left the room, didn't say anything, just left the room. And I knew I was in serious trouble. And he came back in and said, I have never ever criticized you. I could make a list as well. Ooh. and then he left the room again. He left me to deal with my own reaction. He didn't get in there to fix my reaction to his little boundary there. Absolutely right. So this thing about no criticism, it doesn't mean that put in the right way, said at the right time, a suggestion can't be made about how things might helpfully be done differently. But there is a fundamental respect and a recognition that different people look at things in very, very different ways. And once a year, I get a little reminder of that situation, because when we've just had an anniversary, we have the anniversary of when we met, we have the anniversary of when we got married. I mean, we got so many anniversaries. And he always gets me a card with two birds on different branches, but it's always two birds. And he always says, which one's which? And very often I say, that one is me. And he says, how do you know that one is you? I said, because that's the one that's telling the other one off. So we both recognize that that trait, that Al-Anon trait of the prying eyes, monitoring constantly, looking for what needs to change. He recognizes that's still there. It's like a booster dose for tetanus or something. If I, once a year, I get this little shot to say, just watch it for another year and then we're good. And I'm like, there's a character, and this is what I need to be aware of, a character in Downton Abbey. Two of the characters are talking, and one of them says, A says to B, I think I may have said this yesterday, A says to B, I admire you so much. I've never seen such reforming zeal. You see room for improvement wherever you look. And the other person says, I'll take that as a compliment. And the first person says, I must have said it wrong. So my ideal is my other half is perfect as he is. I don't have to overlook so-called defects. My attitude is the way he is perfect, full stop. How do I work with the other person the way they are rather than trying to make them something that they're not? So that's it for the initial talks. We've got some questions now. Do we have any? Oh, have we got a lot? When should a newcomer begin to date? Any suggestions on how they should start that journey? It's a journey, apparently.
Is that for me?
Oh, yes.
I mean, you know, everyone's heard the ideal that you shouldn't start dating in the first year. I met my partner 6 months into my first year, although I'd been in recovery for or been floating around for a couple of years before that. My experience here is that you kind of have to fuck it up yourself, you know. Like, you got to learn by making mistakes. For me, anyway, that was my experience. I mean, obviously, I stayed with my partner, and we ended up being very compatible and soulmates. I've sponsored people who have got together or had lots of relationships in their first year, which have been a complete disaster. So, to be honest, for me, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to that. But Tim, maybe you have a different opinion.
I knew a woman called Louise who was French Canadian, but ended up in Austin in Texas. So she had the toughness of French Canadians, and then that was redoubled with the toughness of Texans. And her advice was always very good on all sorts of things. Just as an aside, her attitude with sponsorship. I was in Texas. I was with my sponsor, my sponsor's wife, who was in AA, and her sponsor, who was Louise. And this, the sponsee of mine sent me a little question. So I put it to the group. how am I going to respond to this? And Louise said, you might as well tell them the truth because they're going to die anyway. Now, with every so-called rule in AA, there's always an exception. And she met, when she was a few years sober, someone came in through the door, and within 3 days they were dating, and they were together for over 40 years, and they had a perfectly happy marriage. Now, those examples, that's not something to sort of wave at your home group and say, have at it. but there's, I don't think there's a fixed rule with this. Let's have another one. How to love the person and hate the addict.
I'll give that a stab. I don't know if hating the addict. I think rather than addict, I'd say maybe some shortcomings of a partner. Not that I'm the judge in the relationship anyway, but I think the best that I can do is focus my attention on the qualities of my partner rather than my judgments of her. And if that means I have to like write a gratitude list every day, like saying the things that I love about my partner, then so be it. But I found that I have a tendency to fault find and to look at the negative parts of anyone or the judgments that I have of people, and in order to counteract that, I have to keep I have to make a conscious effort to look at the qualities that I adore in my partner.
Yeah, I'd echo all of that. There's an American rabbi called Manis Friedman, who is very helpful, I've found, on questions of relationships. And one of the things he talks about is modesty. And in the same way, when one thinks of modesty, one thinks of modest dress in particular. But the notion can be extended. So if someone has got unseemly behaviour or unseemly character defects or is doing things which are unhelpful to them and others, to have the to allow them the modesty of having those without being under constant surveillance. So I don't have to hate the thing that's going on, but I can look past it. I can let them do that and focus on the part of the relationship which is working. But I think there are lots of, in Greek there are different words for love. In ancient Greek, the notions of love are very clearly defined by different authors. And there's this idea that in sort of Western civilization that sort of sex and romantic love necessarily go together, and that those elements are not present in any other types of relationship. It's all very divided up. So I think the principles here actually apply to all sorts of different relationships, whether or not there's anything going on bedroom-wise and whether or not there's anything going on domestically. One can have as strong bonds with other people. And I've had very close relationships, non-romantic in the Western sense and certainly non-sexual, with alcoholics and with addicts. And this question of loving the person, hating the addict, part of patience. The word patience comes from the Latin verb patire, which means to suffer. So to be patient means to suffer watching someone who is suffering without attempting to fix, control, interfere, punish, admonish, and without running away. And so I've had relationships, friendships with people where in the last few years they drank and deteriorated and eventually died. And if I would allow myself to hate the addict or even hate the addiction, to recast that and say they're not very well, that's all. And if they're badly behaved, my other half always says, he can't help it, he's only little. Exactly. To engender a sense of sympathy and respect for the person as well. Next one. How have you used the program during the post-breakup phase?
I don't think I have any experience with this one, to be honest. Do you want to have a go?
In SLA, I'm given to understand, they talk about withdrawal symptoms. A friend of mine from California says regularly, lots of his home groups, he's old, but he lives in a kind of funky town with lots of young people. And they, at the end of some meetings, they say, work it, you're worth it, and all of these little... his home group, basically he wants to institute this chanting, I'm not going to die if I don't get laid, I'm not going to die if I don't get laid. Just so that people know that whatever it is will eventually pass. This friend of mine said, the swelling will go down if you don't scratch it. To focus on everything else, there is plenty to enjoy in life. So this is another good question. I'm very happy with my life and my service and have a lot of love. I have little to no romantic interest. Should I try to handle this interest as a form of service?
I think I've always been someone who's been drawn to romantic relationships, and for, maybe there's something within me that, feels like I need somebody else, perhaps, but I think there's also a lot to be said about the qualities of having a good relationship. I think I learn a lot about myself in a relationship. I think over the last years of practicing these principles in a relationship, it's forced me to become more softer around the edges, and it's forced me to become more compassionate and empathetic, and it's forced me to think about seeing things from another person's perspective. So I think there definitely could be an argument made for seeing a relationship as a form of service, not to the other person, but to yourself and to God, and for bringing love and kindness into another person's life. Then yeah, sure.
Do you want to have a look at, see which of those you might be interested in? I'm going to answer this one. One of the things that I had to get over after a few years of being an AA, an Al-Anon, was the idea that I have to have all the same areas of life that other people do to tick the box to prove I can do it. I have to have a career because you're supposed to have a career. I have to have a relationship because you're supposed to have... You're not... There's this idea... I had a therapist once who said, so many of the problems of the world... the West world seem to come from the television that people watch, which inculcates the idea. Like she said with friends, absolute disaster of a show, because people would come into her office and say, I don't have five best friends. What's wrong with me? And she would have to explain to person after person, this is a television program. This is not reality. And I was certainly brought up with the idea that a romantic relationship is important, and a sexual relationship in particular is important. And I think if you read back into the 19th century, the notion of marriage, and in other cultures as well, the notion of marriage is a vehicle to produce a family, to create a stable unit in which people can live and love and grow and learn and do all sorts of other things. This obsession, and I think romantic obsession was one of my addictions. And I don't think I'm the only one in AA for whom that is the case. So you put lots of people for whom romantic obsession was the thing that was going to fix them in a room together and say, here are some steps. People say, oh, well, once we've done the steps, what we need to do is have a romantic... We need to succeed, as if to make up for all the failures in the past, to prove, I can have a romantic relationship. Look, I'm all right, I'm okay after all. And one of the great freedoms that I think in recovery is my first sponsor said to me, you don't have to become anyone else. You don't have to become me. You have to become yourself. And if that is going to be part of your life, great. And if it's not, great. That's fine. And there's a weird line in the Big Book where it talks about sex. And it says some people would have us on a straight pepper diet, and others would have us have no flavour for our fare. And it always struck me as like a really strange thing to say. But no one advocates eating only pepper. I think I maybe 29 years sober before I realised pepper is a condiment. It's not a food group. Sex is not an area of my life. It is something I might do in one area of my life, which is in an intimate relationship, if I have one. And so sex in my life has been demoted from like one of the chief areas that I have to get right to prove that I'm well, to being, well, if it happens, great. If it doesn't, it's not even in the top 50 priorities in my life. And it's not even in the top 20 aspects of my relationship. There are so many more important things. And that's really taken the pressure off. So,
cool. I'm going to last question. Which of the 12 traditions do you find most helpful when applied to your home life? Should I go first?
Yeah.
I haven't studied the traditions enough to have a favorite tradition when applied to my home life, but what I have found helpful is generally having the perspective of being of service in the relationship, and treating the relationship as if it was a service position, and having the same vision and respect and discipline that I would have if I was turning up to my home group on a Friday night. And taking that same attitude into the relationship. I'm going to leave that.
All 12 traditions can be applied successfully and helpfully in relationships, but there's one in particular that I think solves all sorts of intractable situations, and it's the principle of anonymity in tradition 12, and Bill W. talks about anonymity being the sacrifice of self for the group, the sacrifice of self in favour of the interests of others and the good of all. And sometimes my other half is in a very prominent work position and is under very significant pressure a lot of the time, and is open to a lot of public attack. Very difficult. Now, there are times when he's very available and very giving. There are times where he comes home, he has nothing left to give because he's already given too much at work. And I get to be the silent housekeeper. So I get to do the laundry and do the dinner and be part of the septic environment, the aseptic environment in which this person can heal, with absolutely no demands from my side, to allow the other person the time and space to do whatever they need to do. And there was a 2-year period where, because of various work pressures, there wasn't a lot of availability from his side. And I just bided my time, and then it all sorted itself out. So one's playing a very long game here. It's not 50-50. It's the complete sacrifice of self, which means you've got to pick someone that you're willing to sacrifice for, that is worth sacrificing for. That's all the time we have, I'm afraid. The remaining sessions today are applying the program to work and then service as a way of life. So let's close with the serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you.